Running down dogma with his karma. This is the Drew Marshall Show.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right.
Well, the next 50 minutes look to be extraordinary for a couple of reasons. First of all, one of my favorite guests over the last 13 years is back in our studio. Well, actually, in our studio for the first time because we've never actually met. She's been on the phone a couple of times. Marina Nemeth is well known, of course, for her book, international bestseller, Prisoner of Tehran. She is a human rights advocate. Of course, when you put on your bio, you know, tortured in prison, that gets the attention of a lot of people. But we also want to let everyone know that Marina will be speaking at A Morning of Inspiration, Embracing Change, Empowering Women, Monday, March 7th, 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. That's a long gig. At the Richmond Hill Center for the Performing Arts in celebration of International Women's Day. For more information, go to wcyr.ca. wcyr.ca. What does it stand for, WCYR?
I don't exactly know, but it's a women's organization in York Region,
right.
Basically.
Women's Center, York Region, something like that.
Something
anyway,
like that,
all right.
Yeah.
Marina Nemeth is the website.com. Marina Nemeth, N-E-M-A-T. Am I saying that right, by the way?
Yes, Nemeth? You are, is actually. It? Amazingly well, yeah.
Amazingly
Nemeth.
Well,
yes.
Considering I'm an awkward
usually
white guy?
People say Nemeth, and, you know, that's wrong.
Who says that?
Well, everybody.
Okay. Well, for your third time in the show, you'd think I'd get it right. The other reason I'm excited about this next segment on our show is because there's only one guest in 13 years who's ever given me the hard time that this gentleman has given me. Majid El-Shafi. First of all, I know I didn't say your name right.
No, you didn't know.
See? See? I just can't win with this guy. Majid.
Yes, white guy. Oh, I can't do it.
Well, similar kind of a thing here. We got to get into their stories in a second, but then we got to get on to other things. Tortured for his faith, subject of award-winning documentary Freedom Fighter, and another human rights advocate. As a matter of fact, he won a something for it. Queen's Diamond Jubilee Medal. How long have you been in the country, and you're already winning awards like this? Come on. I've been here my whole life, man, and I haven't won any of these things.
Everybody likes brown sugar. Don't worry about it.
That's just horrible. Horrible. Well, welcome to both of you. Neither of you have met each other, correct?
No.
That's first time.
First time meeting today.
Absolutely.
Well, I'm glad I could facilitate that, because both your stories are captivating. You are both human rights advocates. But you're both from different countries. So, Majid, you're Egyptian, true story?
Yes, sir.
And Marina, you're Iranian?
Yes.
How do you help the rest of us awkward white people figure out the difference between an Egyptian and an Iranian? Not, obviously, I mean, we know they're from different countries, but from a human rights perspective, let's just start right there. You know, Marina, what do you say would be the difference between the struggle for human rights in Egypt versus the struggle for human rights in Iran?
To be honest with you, I think struggle for human rights is a struggle for human rights.
Period.
So for me, yeah, it doesn't matter if you're Egyptian, if you're from South America, if you're from North America. I mean, at the end of the day, freedom is freedom. There has never been a revolution in the history of mankind where people go on the street and they say they want a horrible dictatorship.
Hmm.
So there are a lot of people all over the world, you know, sometimes even in so-called democracies. I mean, we do have issues. So struggle for freedom, to me, no matter where you're from, is struggle for
mm-hmm.
freedom.
Mm-hmm. And Majid?
I agree with her, except that Egyptians is usually more handsome. Anyway.
Oh, gee. You see, this is why. I was nervous about inviting him back.
No, I agree with her. Definitely human rights violation, if it took place in China or Egypt or Iran, wherever it is, there is always a struggle. But if we came to more details, definitely for many years, the Iranian regime now under after the Shah died and buried in Egypt, people been struggling for a while now under the Khomeini regime, and even after Khomeini died, for many reasons, religion. I believe that one of the factors in both countries, the lack of separation between the religion and the state. Hmm. And that's what's happened when the minority getting persecuted, when women's rights become in stake. And we see right now that the people in both countries trying for the best, trying to rise up again. A few years ago, there was the Green Revolution in Iran, where people was getting killed in the street and without any interference from the West to help them in any way, shape, or form.
All right. That is a nice segue into what is the West's responsibility in regards to your people, Marina. The Iranian people are angry at the West, but yet they want the West's help. I mean, what are the dynamics as far as your people are concerned? And by the way, is that cool that I say your people? Is that okay? Or is that
that's fine. I mean, they are my people. I mean, you know, yeah, at the end of the day, we are all human. I mean, all people are everybody's people. But, you know, this is the way we humans divide the world. You know, because I was born in Iran, yes, that is my people. You know, it's just the way things work. So, no, I have nothing against that.
Okay.
But, you know, at the end of the day, yeah, I have been thinking about that. And honestly, every time it is mentioned that, you know, we want the West to do this and that, we want the West to do this and that, I get really, really angry. Because when I was in prison in Iran, I was there in prison for 2 years, 2 months and 12 days. So from 1982 till 1984. And I was 16 to 18 years old. And I wasn't the only one. In prison, the prison that I was in north of Iran, which is completely operational today, had thousands of prisoners, 90% of us under the age of 20 in the 80s. So it was basically high school in hell. And yes, the world was not really talking about it. There was no Facebook. There was no internet back then. The world didn't know or didn't want to know. I really think it didn't want to know. But at the same time, the people of Iran, yes, we were under horrific dictatorship, but many young people in Iran as early as 1980 stood up to the newly formed Islamic regime and spoke against it. And this is why we ended up in prison.
So now, hold on. So you weren't in prison for your faith. You were in prison because of the political climate. You were protesters, basically.
That's right. Yes, we were protesters. So Iran is the majority of the people of Iran are Muslim. So the majority of protesters naturally were Muslim. The majority of my friends were Muslim. I was basically in my school. There were two Christians. But, you know, long story short is that when we were in prison, we were waiting for something. We were waiting for the people of Iran to barge in and free their children who had been arrested by a regime that had promised them freedom and democracy and had not delivered. When we were in prison, I was not waiting for the United States to come and rescue me. I was not waiting for the Great Britain to come and rescue me. I was waiting for my own mom and dad. I was waiting for my own neighbors. I was waiting for my own friends. I was waiting for my own country to come and rescue me from the torture bed and from being raped. And nothing happened. Many, many of us died. Many of my cellmates died there at the age of 15 or 16. And those horrible things that happened, I still believe that before anybody else, it was and it is the responsibility of the people of Iran to stand up and demand the freedom and democracy that they deserve. Now, I understand that there is a cost involved here. I have paid that price. Yes, the West can help. Yes. It is true that the West, when the 2009 situation, you know, the wave of protests were happening in Iran, yes, it would have been nice if the West had given us more moral support. But I don't want the United States to bomb Iran or attack Iran or to do anything of the sort. Because to be honest with you, during the time of Mossadegh, the West actually supported the Shah and killed democracy in Iran. Basically, and we are still paying for it. So I don't want any Western direct intervention in the form of military or anything, because that usually backfires and usually ends badly. But moral support goes a very long way.
What does that look like, though?
What it looks like is basically, for example, I'm going to give you a very fine example of that. Like the Obama administration has negotiated with Iran over the whole nuclear situation. And actually, I am for negotiating with my enemies. I am, because negotiating with one's friends doesn't take a whole lot of talent. We go, we party with our friends. But when you look at the word negotiate, who do you really you should be negotiating with people you don't get along with?
Like your teenage kids.
Oh, absolutely. Tell me about it. That's definitely big. But, you know, the Obama administration, okay, so you want to negotiate and you want to get a deal. That's fine. But nowhere, never did they talk about human rights. Never, ever did they demand that Iran's political prisoners be released. I wrote an open letter to President Obama. I didn't get a response to it. And never, ever did they put any pressure on Iran to improve its human rights record.
Okay, I just heard Majid do a little amen over there. You're getting what she's putting out there. You're understanding this and you feel the same way. You're invested in this negotiation that happened with Iran. You feel that it didn't the way it should have gone?
It's not only that I understand it. Like One Free World International was in the Congress during the time that they were signing on this deal and they was talking about this deal. And we was lobbying in an order for United States, not only United States, but even Europe, not to sign the deal without even putting conditions of human rights, putting human rights front and center. Mm-hmm. And like we spend almost a year lobbying about this. I was in the Congress when this deal was signed. I testified in front of the Congress. It was horrible. And I will tell you why. You have to understand that most of the people was lobbying against that or advocating against this deal was only talking about how Iran terrorist sponsor state, sponsoring Hezbollah, you know, against Israel, you know, they want to commit another Holocaust against the Jews, which is all true. I'm not saying that this is not true. First of all, when we are talking about Iran, it's extremely important that you separate between the government and the people. Because I know a lot of Iranians, they will never agree with their government. So when we say Iran, I'm really talking about the Iranian regime, not the Iranian people.
Right, right, right.
This is number one. Number two, when we went and we start to advocate about the Iranian nuclear deal, I told them it's nothing to do about Israel, it's nothing to do about, you know, the Americans, it's nothing to do about Hezbollah. All of this true, but I'm not here about that. I'm here for the Iranian people. Because the first bullet will be fired, the first victim will not be an Israeli, will not be an American, it will be an Iranian. Mm-hmm. It's a symbol of that. We have to understand when you give a country, it's not only about the $100-150 billion that they will be released to the Iranian regime, it's about lifting the sanctions. And by lifting the sanctions, you made this country more powerful, more strong, and moreover, you are recognizing and you are agreeing with their actions by signing this deal. And here we have a government, new elected government. One of their first decision was accepting this Iranian deal.
You're talking about the Canadian government.
Yes. And this is Iran, the Iranian nuclear deal become our moral dilemma. I'm not against deal with the Iranian government. I'm against bad deal with the Iranian government. And that's where we stand.
So you feel that what just went down recently is a bad deal?
It's a catastrophe.
And your primary reason for saying that is because of the record in human rights atrocities, or because we are empowering – we're basically saying to a nation that has acted – that has misbehaved, we're rewarding their misbehavior? Just concisely package up why you're against this deal.
All the above, all what you said. Like, okay. I don't think that you should choose one against the other.
Right.
I think it's all the above. The truth is that in the last 30-something years, the Iranian regime discriminated against its own people. Religious minorities, if they are Baha'is, if they are Christians, if they are even gay, you know, you hear the stories about the gay community in Iran. They hang them upside down. They cut their genitals in the streets and so on. You hear all of the stories.
True or not? Stories? True or not? Seen it? Can you validate it?
I would say 90% is true because I saw some evidence. However, I need to be sure 100% from the evidence. The one thing that we know for sure 100% that the gay community in Iran will be persecuted.
Yeah.
So when President Obama come and say that he's you know, brew the gay community in the United States. He's only brew the gay community in the United States, not around the world, not elsewhere.
Right.
But the truth and the reality, the persecution that's happening to the minority, supporting of the terrorist organizations. I mentioned the example of the Green Revolution, where the Iranian regime released more than 90,000 soldiers in the streets of their country to killing their own people. First of all, I just want to tell Marina, I'm honored to be with you in the same show. I disagree about one thing that she said. She said that it's up to the people first, and it's true, it's up to the people first. And we saw this in Egypt when the Egyptian revolution came against the Muslim Brotherhood.
Sure.
And after a year from taking over from the Muslim Brotherhood, more than 30 million Egyptians went in the street, and they did change the regime. They brought another general. You see, in Egypt, when you say general election, it means which general will be coming next.
Right.
That's the meaning of general election in Egypt. Anyway, so but the truth and the reality, yes, is the people have to act first. But it's the conscience of the world to do something. We cannot sit down until another genocide happens or another massacre happens.
Right, right.
What's happening in the Green Revolution in Iran, it was a massacre against the people. And the West did not do anything to stop it. And that's the truth.
But hang on, one thing. Mm-hmm. So, but what are you asking the West to do? A military invasion?
I'm not military invasion, but definitely not signing a deal, number one.
No, that's it. Yeah. So, you know. So
this is number one. There was no even diplomat pressure. I don't believe there was serious diplomat pressure. There was not even threat of more sanctions. Completely, there was silence. If you compare between what's happened in Iran, with my old respect, and what's happened in the what's called the Arab Spring, where the world immediately jumped in the Middle East, did something, you know, sometime in military power, sometime in pressure, diplomatic pressure, sometime in financial pressures and so on, not just in Iran, even the countries that supported Iran all along. The West didn't do any of this, in my opinion. There was some condemnation from the foreign affairs. Foreign affairs is so good in making a statement, but that's all what they do.
Yeah, that's right. But that's foreign affairs do. So again, I just want to be clear, because a lot of times when people talk about why doesn't the West do anything, I think the majority of the people in the West, at least the ones I have talked to, they think military invasion.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to be very clear that when we say, you know, we would like the support of the West. Again, I do not think that the West can ever initiate a movement anywhere in the world, or even if it is a weak movement, to even support it and lead it somehow miraculously to democracy. I think that's impossible.
Right.
The only thing the West can do is just provide some sustained moral, maybe economic support to sustain that movement.
Yeah, well, one thing that's interesting here is that whenever, let's say we care about Uncle Joe, and Uncle Joe is an alcoholic, and we want to help Uncle Joe. Well, we can't help Uncle Joe until Uncle Joe initiates the help himself, does something about it himself,
yes.
and then we can walk alongside of Uncle Joe and support him along the way. And I think that's kind of
what you're saying.
Right.
Exactly. So, I mean, that movement needs to be there, and that movement needs to be going somewhere. That movement needs to have a vision of its own. The problem is that with Iran, when the revolution in 1979 happened, I mean, I was there. And even though I wasn't on the streets, I was 13 years old, but a lot of my friends, my family, they were on the streets. And I was a very inquisitive 13-year-old. So I would go to them and I would say, guys, like, I mean, what are we doing exactly? Like, where are we going? What is this Islamic Republic that everybody is so excited about? And they would tell me, oh, you ask too many questions. It's going to be great. Don't worry about it. We just need to get rid of the Shah. And right now you talked about, we just need to get rid of the Islamic government. Nobody has a plan for what's going to come after. How are we going to? So, and this is a recipe for disaster, because that means that the floor is open for another dictatorship.
Mm-hmm. Majid?
We are against, I think normal people is against dictatorship. Normal people.
Normal.
Everywhere in the world.
Thank you for putting me into that category.
No, Majid. I was talking about hair.
Oh,
anyway,
right.
So, no, but I believe that normal people is against dictatorship wherever they are. The problem that what's happening in Iran, happening even in the Middle East with the Arab, what's so called Arab Spring, we turned Arab Spring to be a cold, deadly winter on the freaking minority right there. But what's happened in the region is the same as when you take a dictatorship out, you create a political vacuum. Who's using this political vacuum is the extremists, and that's what's happened in many countries, in Libya and Egypt at some point, in Tunis and, you know, elsewhere. We cannot have a democracy in the Middle East or Iran without establishing two elements. Freedom of religion, number one. Separation between the religion and the state. And both of them cannot be accomplished except through education, education, education. This is how you can create a democracy in the Middle East.
And if I say to you that'll never happen, I think your response is?
I believe it's happened. I don't believe it will never happen. I believe
you
that there
believe,
is a will, there
you
is a
believe
way.
that the Arab nations or the Middle East or over there, as we like to call it, that at some point in time there will be a separation of church and state, that politics won't be influenced by religion.
I believe if there is enough people that they have the will to do something. We saw this happen in Turkey before. This is just an example. Now, Turkey now is a bad example. Please don't.
It's a very bad example.
It's a very bad example. But during the Ataturk time, it was a very good example of separation between the religion and the state. And for many, many years, before this crazy guy that the president now took over, but for many, many years, they have the separation between the religion and the state. I believe that if there is a will, there is a way. And I believe if there is an education, proper education, and once again, if there is a support internationally from the international community, we are all living in the same boat.
Right. Okay. So now we're bringing into the support of the international community. And the international community looks in from the outside and gets educated through media and through news outlets. And depending which news outlet they watch, that depends on what kind of education they get.
Mm.
But and I mentioned this to both of you earlier, the people that I've had on my show over the last while, including Mubin Sheikh, who is our monthly guest here on the show, he sort of gives us the terrorism update. When I say things like, let me bring in another name, Sheikh Hamza Yusuf, who is a well-respected Islamic scholar. When I say, look, your people, and I'm talking about the Islamic people in general, the West is afraid of all these immigration and the Syrians coming over and bringing the Muslim stuff with them and the religion is really kind of screwing with their heads, and it's the religion thing that says to do this, and it's the holy books that says to do this. The pushback I get from these people is no. What it is the Arab culture combined with a lack of education, so ignorance. And then fed into that is the holy books of Islam, and they use that as a justification to do stupid things. So it's not the religion, it's the culture. It's the Arab culture. So let me go to Marina on this one and just say, from a Westerner's point of view, an ignorant Westerner's point of view who only gets educated through media outlets and whatever else, should I be afraid of the Muslim faith, or should I be afraid of the Arabic culture?
You know what? It's kind of difficult to separate things in a logical manner, because it's kind of like the chicken or the egg, if you think about it. What I usually try to do is, because, you know, I lived in Iran for a large part of my life, and when I was living there during the time of the Shah, I mean, we had a secular, a country that was governed by secular laws. I mean, yes, the majority of people were Muslim, but all religions were getting along, you know, women could dress the way they wanted.
Well, then why were they trying to get rid of the Shah?
That's the thing. Because when the father of the Shah came into power, Reza Shah, the father of the Shah before him in the 1930s, he had a vision. He was a man basically ahead of his time. He wasn't perfect. He certainly did not turn Iran into a democracy, but he had a vision. He believed that religion was holding Iran back. So, for example, he basically made the hijab, the covering, the Islamic covering for women. And back then, all women in Iran wore it. Not because somebody was forcing them to do it. It was just that it was a part of the culture. Mm-hmm. You know, it was the way that they had always been. So when Reza Shah came to power, he made the hijab illegal. So if you wore the hijab, you would go to jail.
Whoa.
So, yeah, a lot of people don't know that.
I didn't know that.
So basically, Reza Shah shoved his pretty advanced vision that was, if you want to be on par with the rest of the world, we have to put religion aside. We have to separate religion from government.
So he attempted to implement secularization?
Yes, he did. So basically, he did implement that, and he shoved it down the throat of a people who were not ready for it.
So it backfired.
And this is what backfired many years later. So that is the thing. I believe that, yes, education is definitely an issue. But, I mean, look at it right now. In a country like Iran, how do you go about educating people? It's kind of difficult because the government basically stands in the way.
The government controls the education.
Mm-hmm. Well, the beauty of it, though, is that now we have the internet. And the government has failed to completely control internet.
Right.
So Iranians, and in a lot of other dictatorships, not North Korea. That one is definitely
an exception.
Yeah, it's a different ballgame. But in a lot of these dictatorships, let's say Egypt, let's say in Iran, people have access to information. So, but I mean, I agree with Majid that it will change, that religion will have to loosen its grip on the people and on the country. But in history, one generation is nothing, is a blink of an eye.
Yeah.
I mean, it might take 400 years. We're eventually going to get there, but it's going to take a very long time and a lot of patience. Now,
yeah.
The thing is that in the West, we can only see tomorrow. We never think
much
further.
We can barely see tomorrow.
Exactly.
Yeah. Majid, when it comes to the Syrian refugees that came into Canada, 25,000, we have some in ISIS who are in their propaganda saying, yes, part of our strategy is to have some sort of sleepers in there. Some, you know, you guys are going to bring in some terrorists and not know that they're terrorists. Now, if I was running ISIS, I'd say that thing too, because that creates all sort of chaotic nonsense. So whether it's true or not, it's not the point. The point is, the perception of some Canadians is that we should not be bringing in these Syrian refugees. Now, let's throw into this mix a few things. Number one, Jesus people, should we not be welcoming people who are struggling like this? Number two, we've got homeless veterans on the street, people who fought for this country, who are not being funded appropriately. And then the final thing is, how is this really going to impact our culture? Should we be afraid of potentially more terrorism, acts of terrorism, because we are welcoming all these people in? So do you have a sort of a synopsis, a summary of how you're feeling about the Syrian refugee?
Are you done? Because that's extremely long.
That was
question.
The longest like, question I've ever asked. And like, I asked this to you, sir, because I know you're intelligent enough to be
there
able
is,
to.
There is a reason why a radio show host, not a TV host, and that's exactly it. So anyway.
Nobody else busts my chops like this. Okay.
You have, before I start, you have to remember that I'm a refugee myself. So I came to this country as a refugee. I ate as a refugee. I drink as a refugee. I bleeded as a refugee. First of all, Canada and the Canadians shall open their heart, our home, to the refugees to help them. If you are Jesus people or not Jesus people, that's not the question here.
Okay.
I'm a blessed to be a Jesus man, but there is many also good, wonderful people around us that they are not. Doesn't mean that we discriminate against them or anything in this way. Four things we have to explain, and four points extremely important that we have to discuss, even if they are not politically correct when it comes to the refugee issues. Number one, remember what I said in the beginning. We have to open our hearts and our doors to the refugees to help them and to rescue them.
Mm-hmm.
Even though after 4 years now we are talking about this, and that's because just there is a little boy by the name Alan Kurdi, they found him, you know, face down.
The picture of the dead boy on the beach.
This has been happening for 4 years. But suddenly, a photographer decided to take a picture. Suddenly, the whole world decided to act on something. It's okay. Now it's over, by the way. Like,
yep.
Now when you speak about the refugees, oh, come on now. Are we still talking about that?
Yeah,
it's over. Anyway. Yep. Number one, we have to bring the refugees in a balance with protecting our country and the security of our nation. There is nothing wrong with a balance. You can help, and you still can balance your act. This is why. Because if we start without worry about our security, if we did it without proper penance and proper check on the process that we are doing, we simply will get hurt. somebody will take advantage of that. And if we are unable to help ourselves, we will be unable to help others. To maintain healthy refugee movement with a proper process, with a proper shakeout, like you shake the process, you will maintain healthy Canada. By maintaining healthy Canada, you will be able to maintain helping people more and more in the long run, not just in the short period. Mm. Did you been in a plane before when the flight attendant tell you when the mask, oxygen mask, yep, go down, put it in your first, yep, before you put it in your child? Yep. I demonstrated that one time, and I was against her, and I told her, well, I will put it on my son first. She said, no, if you cannot help yourself, you will not be able to help him. That's exactly it. We have to maintain Canada secure. We have to maintain Canada healthy in an order to help more and more and more refugees.
Okay.
There is nothing wrong in having both balances.
Yep.
Number one.
You're only on number one?
Yes, exactly. It was long question.
It was a long question, okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Just want to let you know, we have 5 minutes left in the show.
Number two.
Yes.
We have to understand and we have to remember as well that with the refugee movement, we have also to help the people on the ground. So our aid and our international aid and our have also to continue. Now, without military protection, you are dropping aid on a dead people. So there is always a solutions of green zones protecting the most vulnerable. Refugees, minorities, gay women, children, all of this have to be in place. Mm-hmm. There is one question that nobody wants to ask, and I would really like to ask it in this show. If there is a reason why the Muslim countries like Saudi Arabia and Qatar and Emirates and Dubai and all of these countries don't want to accept refugees, why they are not accepting refugees?
Right.
Why is all coming to Europe, all United States and Canada, why no pressure on the Arab Muslim countries to accept more refugees, knowing that they have enough resources?
From what I understand, that has to do with the division within Islam and the two factions, and those countries are more of one and the refugees are the other.
I have, quite honestly, I don't think that this is the reason.
Yeah, Sunni Shia.
Right.
Not
so this,
necessarily.
I don't think so.
Is a division between the Sunni and Shiites, but the majority of refugees are not Shiites.
They're Sunni.
Okay. So they are the same religion as the United Arab
correct.
Emirates and Saudi Arabia. Mm. No, the problem is elsewhere. The problem is elsewhere.
Yeah.
You can't just leave it with
well,
that.
Well, you said there's 5 minutes.
Oh.
You said 5 minutes on the show, and Tim is like looking at you.
Okay. What do you mean? Just quickly, what do you mean the problem is elsewhere?
Well, the thing is that, well, you know, I believe that with the United Arab, I don't even have ever been there. I haven't, but I have a lot of friends who own even businesses in the area. From what I understand, you know, the way these countries, they do business is that they are very protective of their way of life and their wealth. And they don't want any outsiders. And I mean, the population of the United Arab Emirates, I don't even know what that is, you know, but it can be tipped in the directions that they don't want it to tip if they let refugees
so
in.
Once
so
they open the doors, protected. They're going to be in, they'll be flooded with people that'll affect their economy
exactly.
and affect their way
the
of living.
Power,
the
affect
power.
The power.
The power.
The power. Oh. So this is these are small families who hold not millions, but billions and billions and billions of dollars.
So why, then it wouldn't
they
matter. And why are they? So it's
they
just an insecure
threatened.
Thing.
Yes. They want more money. They
people
want
with
more
fancy
power.
Cars.
Yeah, people with fancy
okay.
cars.
Okay, Marina, we've got to finish with this. Majid, you're a human rights advocate. Marina, you're a human rights advocate, but you're a woman.
Yeah, last time I checked that.
And you are advocating for human rights in countries where, pardon my ignorance, but from what I understand, women are not as important as men.
Yes, they basically legally have half the rights of men.
Right.
If not less.
So wouldn't it be better, wouldn't you have more impact doing what you are doing if you were a man?
No, I don't think so. Actually, I think it goes
the other way.
Yeah, it goes the other way because women from the Middle East, they look at me and they think, well, she's doing it. She can do it. Mm-hmm. She has a voice. She's on the international stage. Once I was in a conference and this was in Europe, this was in Italy, and I looked around me. There were hundreds of presenters. They had put all of us. It was a huge conference. They had put all of us in one room, kind of like a mingle between all the presenters. Mm-hmm. I was the only woman, probably between 500 men. And I looked around. Mm. It didn't make me feel intimidated. I actually felt empowered. I said, look at me.
You go, girl.
Yeah, exactly. Why not?
Yeah, I just said that. To find out more about Marina, to get her book, to read her story, to just, I don't know, do you have keychains and coffee mugs for sale?
Not yet.
MarinaNamet.com, MarinaNamet.com, N-E-M-A-T. And, of course, Reverend Majid Al-Shafi. He's so subtle. You know, the interesting thing about this conversation is, from a media perspective, the more dynamic aspect of you guys is your story. I mean, we didn't even touch on your story. We've had your story on the show before, so you can go to our website and maybe listen to it if it's still there. But, boy, you've both to be tortured in prison, just crazy stuff. We are sucky, whiny people compared to the stuff that you guys have gone through.
Yes, you are.
Thank you. Freedom Fighter is the name of the movie and the book, and the website for Majid is...
One Free World International.
One Free World International. I was actually going to say that. OneFreeWorldInternational.org. Thank you both for being
Thank
here.
Thank you. Thank you
so much.
Thank you.
We need to have you again another time with more time. Folks, that's the end of our show. I hope all of you, each and every one of you, find the God who sees you. Bye-bye.